Good afternoon. You are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming live at freakradio.org. That's freakradio.org. Go to our main webpage and follow. Let's see. Click on the contact link to get the instructions on how to listen to our free streaming web. Free streaming online web thing. We're also broadcasting on the regular old radio at 101.3 FM. Free Radio Santa Cruz, and this is the Mideast Migraines program.
بدور حظي ملون أبو العروس زعلان مني أم العروس ما تكلمني وأنا خايف يصيبني ده جنون لأقولي بيتنا اتجوز وبكون ممنون بس اليوم بدي وحدي مع امك دي امل هدي وانا قابله كيف ما كان يكون لقوني بيت يا حبايب وبكون ممنون
لقوني بيت لا اتجوز وبكون ممنون من يوم ليوم شغل بالي هم البيوت يا والحالي وانا قابله كيف ما كان يكون لأقول بيت يا جماعة وبصير ممنون الجرايد اعلانات صرنا حاطين عم نترجى ونتدخل يا رم بتعين في الجرايد اعلانات صرنا حاطين عم نترجى ونتدخل يا رم بتعين ما عاد فينا نستنى تنلاقي بيت ونتهنى وانا قابله كيف ما كان يكون لقولي بيت يا حبايب وبصير ممنون
Thank you. فين وين ما درنا نلاقي بدنا جمعتين شهر العسل بيمضى ونصفي فين خافوا الله عينونا يا ملكين واستورونا ونقابلوا كيف ما كانتون نقول بيت نتجوز وبصير ممنون
نقول بيت نتجوز
بكون ممنون يوم ليوم وانا بدور حظي ملعون ابو العروس زعلان مني ام العروس ما تكلمني وانا خايف صبني ده جنون لقول بيت يتجوز وبكون ممنون
Yes, this is your friendly neighborhood local Palestinian American, Lawrence Rentoul, reporting from behind the microphone of Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is the Monday edition of Mideast Migraines. A little bit pressed for time here. Forgive me for not hitting the cough button like I'm supposed to before they pull my license. Well, let me see. Let me give out the phone number to the studio here. We're located in Santa Cruz County on the central coast of California here. Liberalsville. Hippie Haven. At least that's what the students of UCSC used to say about their lovely campus environment back in the 70s. It's a more respectable university environment now, though. From what I understand, phone number. Area code for Santa Cruz County, 831. Line one, direct to the studio. We have two lines here. Line number one is 427-3772. Again, that's 427-3772. Line two, same area code, 831. 469-3119. 469-3119. Oh, whether or not you have anything, and I mean anything at all, to say about the content of this program and to deign to get into a dialogue with yours truly here, aside from the immediate subject matter, I'm always looking for any input from my listeners. Even if this is the first time you happen to come across this show or perhaps made it a point to listen to an episode of Mideast Migraines, I need to hear from people about the direction that you think this program should be going if it's not going that way. It's always nice to hear encouragement, and I've gotten plenty of encouragements from people about what I'm doing. I'm waiting for more substantial criticisms here. At least that way I know that someone is listening. Whether they intend to listen again or not, I want to hear from my homies out there, my listeners, my fans, about whether or not you think this is going the right way. Because after all, I would like people to return to the show if they like what they're hearing. And if they don't like what they're hearing, provide some feedback and tune in again to see if your feedback takes. Right here, folks, just double-checking some pots on the old board here. All right. Let me begin with something that I came across from, of all places, Quartz. Quartz. by way of MSN News, this is a subject that I only recently became aware of, actually about a year ago, I suppose, when I was reading Max Blumenthal's Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel on my Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines, which still comes to you every Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 1100 hours. I'm currently on another book. I'm reading Witness in Palestine, an American Jewish woman's an American Jewish woman in the occupied territories, referring, of course, to the land of Palestine as it is continuously occupied by Israel and its oh-so-noble defense forces, as they like to call them. The matter of internet trolls. Now, this article written by Kabir Chabir, whoever Kabir Chabir is, as a news item, as I said on MSN News, Microsoft Network News, really has more to do with the activity of trolls, T-R-O-L-L-S. Most of you, I'm sure, have at least heard of those. Their activity on in chat rooms and amongst people on social gab networks, informal or formal. That's what this really article has to do with. I personally am more interested in the matter of people who have fixed opinions about books that have been written and other subject matter, and who are making it a point to either deluge the chat board with positive that are either ultra positive with as many of their people as they can, or ultra negative in order to diss the work of literature or whatever it is. You know, those kind of political trolls, that's my interest. This really has to do more with social media. Let's just get to it and find out what they're talking about here. Science can now spot trolls after just 5 horrible, malicious comments. Says here, people aren't very nice to each other online. Everyone has read a comment thread and been annoyed at the vicious remarks or witnessed a flame war under a YouTube video. Many online communities now have moderators, and they aim to ban trolls, those people who just can't stay civil. But can you identify trolls before they ruin a community? Researchers from Stanford and Cornell universities think they can, after analyzing 18 months' worth of discus threads from the news site CNN, the right-wing political site Breitbart, and the gaming site IGN. That amounted to 1.7 million users, almost 40 million comments, and 100 million up or down votes on those comments. They compared users who were later banned from a community with users who were never banned. Of the trolls, which is to say the ones banned from the community, of the trolls, they observed the following. We find that such users tend to concentrate their efforts in a smaller number of threads, are more likely to post irreverently, and are more successful at garnering responses from other users. Studying the evolution of these users from the moment they join a community up to when they get banned, we find that not only do they write worse than other users over time, but that they also become increasingly less tolerated by the community. Further, we discover that antisocial behavior is exacerbated when community feedback is overly harsh. Using that, they developed an algorithm that can look at those factors and determine with 80% accuracy whether the troll will be banned in the future. based on the content of their first five posts. The most powerful predictor is the reaction to and deletion of posts by moderators. But even without manual labeling, the algorithm still works with 79% accuracy. Interestingly, the researchers said it becomes, quote, increasingly difficult to identify a troll and determine whether they'll be banned the longer they have been posting. Quote, this suggests that changes in both user or community behavior do occur leading up to a ban, the scientists said. I'll read that again. This suggests that changes in both user or community behavior do occur leading up to a ban, the scientists said. The researchers' work was supported by a Google Faculty Research Award. So perhaps we'll see this algorithm being used to identify and banish online trolls sooner rather than later. But as the researchers note, a success rate of 80% means that 1 in 5 users are still misclassified as trolls when they are just antisocial. What to do about this? The researchers are hopeful. And there's a colon here, so they have... This is leading up to this paragraph. Whereas trading off overall performance for higher precision and have a human moderator approve any bans is one way to avoid incorrectly blocking innocent users. A better response may instead involve giving antisocial users a chance to redeem themselves. Okay, so we have someone who, according to MSN News, is some research team from Stanford and Cornell universities, finally looking at the problem of antisocial behavior and people in groups of people who deliberately contribute in a negative way to the social scene, or perhaps to a book that's being reviewed, or a radio program, or TV, or whatever. Obviously, you know, anytime I think I've determined that anytime you read an article with the word algorithm in it, as soon as you come across the word algorithm, there's going to be a nod off and snore element among the people who are listening. So we're talking, at least they are dealing with algorithms, which definitively means something like a scientific equation or set of equations, and a steady implementation of that formula. I'm sure I'm putting people to sleep just by saying, trying to explain this. Algorithms have to do with a way that becomes established to determine things, determine the likely outcome, determine a percentage of something. In this case, 79% to 80%. So, trolls are indeed real people. According, I'm kind of synopsizing this article, trolls are real people who, whether they do this in concert or not, seem only interested in bringing down a chat community, any kind of chat community, book reviews or social networking, casual, formal, whatever. A troll is someone who basically is looking for trouble, either in the form of wrecking that community, destroying that chat activity, or just being negative and antisocial. But the important thing is, these researchers at the universities that I mentioned think that they've come to a mathematical conclusion about how often these people come on, what percentage of the time they appear, and within as few as five, as it says, horrible or malicious comments can be identified as regular abusers of that chat scenario. And but at least the article does end with the hopeful human element of the suggestion that a human moderator approve any bans on a particular malicious user as one way to avoid incorrectly blocking innocent users. Or rather, a better response may instead involve giving antisocial users a chance to redeem themselves. Okay. A lot of you are still shaking your heads and going, huh? What are you talking about anyway? We're talking about trolls. Anyone who's done any chatting on the net, not so much one-on-one IMs, individual messaging, but chatting within a group when you don't necessarily know who the people are, when they use false names or avatars and no further or not much further identifying information, so that person is free to drop their little bombs and time bombs into the community and wreck everything. I wanted to say something about trolls. I thought that this was going to be, when I first saw the headline of this article, "Science Can Outspot Trolls After Just 5 Horrible Malicious Comments," I immediately thought of the way that I usually run into troll activity, and that's when I'm reviewing a book on Amazon or making comments on a political article in the internet article readers comments section following the article. So I gravitated to it, but it turns out they're talking, I think what they're saying has more to do with social scenarios, people talking, chatting on social internet stuff. If you are a person who enjoys this kind of chat activity, following, paying attention to, or contributing to a community of chatters, then you have a rough idea of what I'm talking about. At any rate, I wanted to let you know that scientists are starting to pay attention to predicting how these people come up. Let me give you the phone numbers again so you can say something perhaps about trolls. If you're a troll out there, you may know who you are. I think there might be some more sociopathic people who don't even realize that they are this way. But if you just suspect you might be a troll, or whether even if you don't, if you know perfectly well that you're not a troll, give me a call here at area code 831-427-3772. That's line number 1-427-3772. Line 2, by the way, is 469-3119. The lines are open. Line 2, 469-3119. This is the Mideast Migraine Show, the Monday edition, which comes to you every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific Time on Free Radio Santa Cruz. My name is Ren. Honest, it really is. Has been for the past 5 years or so, anyway. It's 3:25 in the afternoon, by the way. Okay. As is the normal course of events here, I tend to talk a lot about Palestinians. Being a Palestinian-American myself, I tend to have a rather dramatically different take on events over there in the so-called Holy Land across the sea than most people in this country appear to have. Let's begin with another item from... Oh, no, no. I was going to say... Okay. No, not David Schermerhorn. This appeared in the Sacramento Bee last Friday, April 17. From the Sacramento Bee, "Criticizing Israel is not anti-Semitism." This was written by one Liz Jackson. Where are you, honey? Oh, there it is. Squeezed in at the bottom. Liz Jackson is a staff attorney with Palestine Solidarity Legal Support and cooperating counsel with the Center for Constitutional Rights. So you know right away if you're going to give any credence to this person, a lawyer associated with Palestine Legal Support, if you're going to give any credence to this person at all, or absolutely all of your credence to them, or just be kind of neutral and responsible and listen to what she has to say. Okay. Criticizing Israel is not anti-Semitism. Recent issue of the Sacramento Bee. Many black, Arab, gay, and other students who experience daily acts of racist violence and blatant discrimination will be aghast at Tammy Rossman Benjamin's opening declaration at a recent Viewpoints article called Jewish Students Need More Protection on California Campuses, April 10. Perhaps Viewpoints article refers to something in the Bee, Sacramento Bee. We'll be aghast at Rossman Benjamin's declaration there that, and I quote, Jewish students are the single most vulnerable minority, end quote, at the state's universities. As a Jewish alumna of University of California at Berkeley, I, writer Liz Jackson, am alarmed at this attempt to elevate Jewish suffering over the experiences of other victims. To defeat one form of racism, we have to oppose them all. As an attorney for Palestine Solidarity Legal Support, I helped organize efforts to renounce the Campus Climate Report and House Resolution 35, which Rossman Benjamin cites because both measures mischaracterize the campus climate for Jewish students, falsely branded advocacy for Palestinian rights as anti-Semitic, and made patently unconstitutional recommendations to restrict campus speech. Again, and made patently unconstitutional recommendations to restrict campus speech. I, Ms. Jackson, applaud the Department of Education's dismissals of complaints against three UCs, University of California's campuses, alleging that advocacy for Palestinian rights creates a hostile environment for Jewish students. Department civil rights officers conducted lengthy investigations and soundly rejected the theory that criticism of Israeli policy is anti-Semitic. The department got it right in saying that Palestinian rights advocacy is protected speech and that, I quote here, robust and discordant expressions, end quote, are to be expected on college campuses. Robust and discordant expressions are to be expected on college campuses. Jewish students do not need new or extra protections beyond the civil rights laws that safeguard every other ethnic and religious minority. What upsets Benjamin, Tammy Rossman Benjamin here, is that authorities have rightfully refused to distort those laws, to censor criticism of the Israeli government. A newly proposed state Senate resolution, SCR 35, is again raising eyebrows for its widely rebuked definition that conflates criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. Rather than heed Rossman Benjamin's call to punish and restrict student speech favoring Palestinian rights, legislators should take note of the warnings sounded in another Viewpoints article that appeared the same day. Namely, quote here, violate student free speech rights, prepare to be sued, end quote. Apparently that was the title of the Viewpoints article, violate student free speech rights, prepare to be sued. The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education has sued multiple California public schools that, quote, learned about the First Amendment the hard way. Legislators, university administrators, students, and civil rights advocates should all remain vigilant stewards of our public campuses where advocacy for all minority rights, including Palestinian rights, is protected and even welcomed. Again, author of the article, Liz Jackson, is a staff attorney with the Palestine Solidarity Legal Support and cooperating counsel with the Center for Constitutional Rights. This article appearing in last Friday's Sacramento Bee, Sacramento, California, of course. Let me just remind people here that the original H.R. 35, House Resolution 35, mentioned, which was the first 35 mentioned in this article, came up sometime last year, I think about a year ago anyway, in the California Assembly, which was passed as a non-binding resolution, and something very interesting happened after that flew through the California Assembly into passage. For one thing, it was not legally binding, and of course, you have it was at least apparent to people that the wording of H.R. 35 appeared to protect the interests of Jewish students on California State College campuses who felt threatened by activity supporting Palestinian rights. And of course, as is the norm in the United States, legislators wasted no time in standing shoulder to shoulder, as it were, with Israel and pro-Israel Jews in the United States and pro-Israel non-Jews in the United States, and wanted to be recognized as standing shoulder to shoulder with them, and wanting to avert a new American Holocaust, or however they saw it. Turns out that a number of the signers balked when they were assailed by those who tend to stand openly for Palestinian rights and for Palestinian American rights and Palestinians in the United States. When they feel threatened, or when they recognize that Palestinians and Palestine and Israel are being threatened, when some of these legislators came forward, a few of them did, probably very few anyway, and they stated openly, I believe our own local assemblyman Bill Moaning came out and said, "Well, yes, I signed it, but I was given the impression that that it itself was not discriminatory, and that it was not a threat to open and free speech. I signed it because I thought I was doing the right thing." And so you have assemblymen and assemblywomen who came out and said, it was a rather flighty document. It did go through pretty quickly, didn't it? And they admitted that they didn't really take a close look at it in most cases, and didn't really give it all that much thought. They just took it for granted that it was another expression of support for American Jews and for support of Israel. They didn't think about the legal consequences and all of the things that have to do with threatening the rights of Palestinians, as is expressed on college campuses. And anyway, that was the stuff of the original H.R. 35. And now they mention something that's brand new to me, a newly proposed state Senate resolution, S.C.R. 35, is again raising eyebrows for its widely rebuked definition that conflates criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. This is only the latest of countless times that I've come across items in the press, articles that have to do with how wrong it is to automatically and straight across the board link anti-Semitic activity or Jew-hating activity with the action of criticizing Israel for its governmental activities, what its military does, for policies that it supports, for how there is a distinctly growing gap between parity of equal rights between Israeli Arabs Another word for them is Palestinians, who are Israeli citizens, between them and Israeli Jews, or between Israeli Jews and Israeli non-Jews. This is a growing problem and is starting to come under more scrutiny. And the knee-jerk reaction of so many people who support Israel all too often is immediately cry foul, cry, this is anti-Semitism, you're saying this just because you hate Jews. Well, what about the element that supports at the very least listening to what the Palestinians have to say, or the Israeli Arabs, if you will, have to say about their suffering, about what they perceive as an inequity in society, or what the Palestinians under Israeli occupation in the occupied territories, and that includes the Gaza Strip, because it is effectively under Israeli military occupation for a variety of reasons, to begin to scrutinize that life for those people there. Okay, now before I get any flightier, let's continue. It's 3:37 in the afternoon this Monday, April 20th, 2015. And if that jives with your own personal time-space continuum, now 3:38 p.m. on April 20th. If that jives with you, then you know the program is live and not a rerun, so give me a call here at area code 831-427-3772 or line 2, 469-3119. And just as soon as I can... just get an idea of who's listening to us now. That's always something I like to do. I can do that with my magic box. Okay. At least people who are listening online, I can get an idea of how many of those there are. Oh, it's a nice day. I guess everyone is out. Okay, let's just continue here. Now, here's the item from my beloved friend, whom I met 6 years ago overseas, David Schermerhorn. David Schermerhorn, he was a shipmate of mine aboard the SS Free Gaza when we, an activist aboard the SS Liberty, sailed in tandem from the island of Cyprus, Greek Cyprus, to... the Gaza Strip, we sailed into the port of Gaza City. Mighty sailor man he, David Schermerhorn. I read an item from him, I believe, at the last show, and I am... I hold this man in the highest esteem for his writing ability as well as his ability to research these things and decipher and come to his own... laudable conclusions. Jerusalem to... Actually, he calls this a hearted letter to Bibi. Bibi, of course, referring to Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, Benjamin Netanyahu. Bibi, a hearted letter to Bibi by Schermerhorn. Jerusalem and Babylon. It's time to learn from history, Bibi. A response to the Prime Minister's accusation that the West has forgotten the lessons of the Holocaust. This is... Okay, actually, this was not written by my friend Schermerhorn. It's passed along by him, but I still think it's pretty important stuff. This was written by one Anshel Pfeffer. Anshel Pfeffer. Open letter. A very heartened letter, as he puts it here. Dear Bibi... We are going to send you the annual letter congratulating you on another year of Israeli independence next week as usual. But since you saw fit to address us on Wednesday night at the Yad Vashem ceremony opening Holocaust Remembrance Day and made us the main focus of your speech, we felt it would be better to write a bit earlier this year. In your speech, you accused us of having forgotten the lessons of the Holocaust. A of being weak and deluded, and therefore eager to appease a genocidal Iranian regime bent on the destruction of Israel. You deduce the entire moral bankruptcy of the, quote, enlightened West. Interesting that you single out the West in your speech, but fail to mention Russia, which is actively arming Iran. From our position on the P5 plus one talks with Iran, our decision to try and come to a deal with Iran on its nuclear program is proof enough for you that we have forgotten history and are failing to learn the lessons of the Holocaust. Let's put aside the argument over whether this is the best course to try and prevent Iran from reaching a nuclear weapon. We argue that every other week of the year, and obviously this, and obviously, weird sense. We argue that every other week of the year, and obviously we'll continue doing so. But ask yourself this. Would we have spent so many months wrangling over a deal if we didn't feel we had to prevent Israel's main enemy from acquiring the weapon it could use to eliminate the Jewish state? Has there ever been such a comprehensive set of international sanctions on a country, which is also Israel's arch nemesis? If you think we are so eager to just roll over and do business with Tehran, would we have spent all this time and effort and erected so many obstacles instead of just going ahead and doing it? We're doing all this precisely because we have learned from those terrible chapters in history. You may be right. We may be going about this the wrong way, and you have ample opportunity to lobby against our policy. We remember Munich, 1938, Munich, Germany. We remember also the conference at Evian 2 months earlier in July 1938, when no country was prepared to take in Jewish refugees barely a year before the storm engulfed them. We've learned from history. That's why every few weeks our best diplomats are back at some hotel in Switzerland, we've gone to Kazakhstan as well, sitting through interminable sessions on numbers of centrifuges and levels of enrichment, because we haven't relinquished our historical duty. You are right to be skeptical of our methods, but not our motives. There are many reasons we want to stop Iran from being a nuclear power, but if Israel's security wasn't one of them, if Israel's security was not one of them, do you really think we would have gone to such an effort? After all, as you constantly remind us, we failed with North Korea. But we didn't put up half the fight with them we are now putting up with Iran. Draw your own conclusions for what historical reasons we have been doing this. Bibi, you recently described yourself as the spokesman, quote, for all the Jewish people, end quote. And as elected leader of the only Jewish state, you have some claim to this title. But don't forget that more Jews live in our countries, other countries of the world, than in Israel. Twice as many Jews voted for President Barack Obama in 2012. That's a direct and personal expression of trust in his leadership. Twice as many for Obama than voted for your Likud party last month. Let me break in here. Obviously, we're dealing with the relative population of a much, much, much larger nation, the United States, compared to Israel. So I don't know if this is a per capita expression or if they're simply counting up Jewish voters in each country. So who knows what that is. Anyway, continuing. You said in your speech, that when the survivors of the concentration camps emerged after liberation, only the Jews had no country to go to. You know that historically, that is at best only half true. Of course, many of the survivors made their way to Palestine, where 3 years later, with the backing of our votes in the United Nations, a Jewish state was founded. Don't forget the billions Israel received, not only in reparations from Germany, but in aid from other countries as well, to help those survivors have a new life, to build Israel's economy and equip the Israel Defense Forces. Yes, we learned from Europe's terrible history. But many Jewish survivors found other countries they now call home. You know many of those survivors personally. You even tried to convince one of them, a U.S. citizen, to become Israel's next president instead of Ruby, who you so despise. We were silent earlier this month when you called upon Europe's Jews to flee in the face of Islamist attacks. Europe's Jews to flee. But don't think we failed to notice the insult you caused our citizens by telling them they should leave their chosen homeland. We don't begrudge you your responsibility for the safety of Israel's citizens and for ensuring Israel remains a secure haven for other Jews who in the future choose or are forced by persecution to live there. But as long as they choose to live among us, we take our responsibility toward them very seriously. We learned that much from history. At no previous time have so many public funds been allocated in our countries to protecting Jewish communities, to supporting Jewish culture, education, and religious life, and yes, to teaching all our students what happened in the Holocaust and the terrible price we pay when we forsake our responsibility to our fellow human beings. We know, we feel you are unfairly judged by parts of our media and some of our parliamentarians. Quite often, you're right. A lot of the coverage of Israel is disproportionate and fails to take into account the real challenges you face. We get treated pretty roughly by them ourselves, and certainly some of the more radical elements exercise double standards when judging us. When judging us also. But you have a free press as well, and we're not about to hold you accountable for everything they write or broadcast. Not every unfair criticism toward you is rooted in anti-Semitism, though there is still a fair amount of that about. And we have never been so resolute in showing its zero tolerance. Don't feel so hard done by. There is a double standard toward Israel, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. You get a lot more stick than many nasty regimes because you aspire to be, quote, the only democracy in the Middle East. None of those regimes have the level of trade you have with us, except for oil, but even that's changing, or receive anything near the amount of aid, grants, subsidies, and other incentives Israel does. None of them share our intelligence secrets or have the sorts of access you have either. And while we're on the subject of double standards, how about another issue on which we treat Israel differently than any other nation? Since this is a private letter, reading it to you now on public radio. Since this is a private letter, we can mention here the project down in Dimona, the one we never bring up in public, because we understand Israel's unique need to have the ultimate guarantee for its survival. And yes, because we trust you not to use it in an irresponsible and belligerent manner. So, no sanctions, no reports, no pressure to join non-proliferation treaties. Instead, you get subsidized submarines from Germany. Not that the thought of it doesn't make us uneasy, but we really do understand because we have learned from history. Let's hope we can keep trusting each other on that. You have your responsibility to your citizens. By the way, did you really think we wouldn't notice how you maligned 20% of your citizens last month? Must be referring to the election in Israel. You have your responsibility to your citizens, and we respect that. We admire the fact that you've succeeded in being a democracy throughout your entire existence, within the green line, that is. But that's another argument. We'll get back to it in a week. It can't have been easy with no prior experience, and while we're going to war every few years. 67 years ago, most of us still ruled colonies overseas, and none of those nations who became independent around when you did have done nearly as good a job at building their own democracies. But another lesson we learned from history is that democracy building takes time. So, Shagat Smaut Semeach, BB, forgive me for not knowing the translation, Chag Atzmaut Semeach. Since we're being honest, we would have preferred to have been writing this letter to Bogie, but that's not Israeli democracy for you. We admire the process, even if we're not always happy with the results. As long as you are still the only Israeli prime minister to have been born in an independent Israel, first and only, perhaps we can ask you to start learning from history and act your age. Happy Independence Day, the, quote, enlightened West. Okay, of the many things I want to say about this article, written by Anshel Pfeffer, a hardened letter to Bibi, as is the case with most of what I read on this radio program, Mideast Migraines, which comes to you exclusively on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, and streaming live and free at freakradio.org, I do not personally do all the research which would be needed to verify all the facts or purported facts that I state in the article. I would never get much of anything done if I had to fact-check all of this stuff. So I present these items, which I do indeed select on my own, solitarily, for reading on the program, based largely on subject matter and to a degree on content. But I do not fact-check every last item which is put forth in them. For example, I know that there is something to the statement here. We were silent earlier this year when you, Benjamin Netanyahu, called upon Europe's Jews to flee in the face of Islamist attacks. That's the kind of thing that's more likely to be conveyed in mainstream Western media, possibly as a strict criticism of the Israeli prime minister to encourage Europe's Jews to repeat history and flee in the face of Islamist attacks, as though Islamists are the current incarnation of German Nazism. So I know there's some truth to that. But then the writer goes on and talks about a number of other things. He talks about Dimona. Dimona is a town, or more perhaps more accurately, a small city in Israel, which is the center of Israel. As everyone pretty much knows, Dimona is the birthplace and center of Israel's nuclear and nuclear weapons industry and arsenal. No sanctions, no reports, no pressure to get Israel to join the nuclear non-proliferation treaties. That's also a given. I was not previously aware that there was not necessarily any pressure on Israel to do that, but I'm not at all surprised to hear that. So my point is, you know, I do not fact check every last item that's put forth in these articles. If you want to do fact-checking with me, or if you want to dispute anything that I'm reading to you, give me a call at area code 831-427. 3772. Line 1 is 427-3772. Line 2 is 469-3119. 469-3119. Now, the other thing that I was having difficulty with is in the first paragraph, let me just read you the first paragraph again here, and trying to identify exactly who this writer, Anshel Pfeffer, represents. We are going to send you the annual letter congratulating you on another year of Israeli independence next week as usual. But since you saw fit to address us on Wednesday night at the Yad Vashem ceremony opening Holocaust Remembrance Day, you made us the main focus of your speech. We felt it would be better to write a bit earlier this year. So, okay, I was a little confused. I thought these were the people at Yad Vashem, which is the name of the Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem, I believe. But no, it was talking about the Prime Minister making his address at Yad Vashem. So this person is talking about being a member of the West, in quotes, in general, across the sea from Israel, Europe, the United States. So this author seems to be speaking himself, I believe it's a him, Anshel Pfeffer, as the representative of many in the West and their take on what Prime Minister Netanyahu is doing. This person is clearly a leftist and highly critical of Israel. Whether the author is Jewish or not, frankly, I do not know. Again, the name is Anshel Pfeffer, P-F-E-F-F-E-R, Pfeffer. So there you have that. Thank you, David Schirmerhorn, for passing that along to us. Let's have some music just to take a break here. It is 2 minutes before 4 p.m. this Monday, April 20, 2015, from my much-loved personal compact disc, The Music of Arab Americans, a retrospective collection. You have already heard from the latest going back, number 7, La'uli Bait, or Find Me a House, dating back to about 100 years ago, really, close to it. Before that was Waqif Ala Shat Bahir, Standing on the Shore, about 1940s. Remember, this is a retrospective album of early Arab Americans, not directly from overseas. And before that, you heard, I believe I opened the show with Raqs Arabi, or Arabic Dance. Mid-20th century. Here's another one for you.
Oh. وبتقول لهم مداني بإصارة وعون يا هلب العواطف في تخلد لي الورى عزة وجودي إلهي العرش ساعدني وجودي وعلي سهل أمور السعود يا عين يا عين يا عين يا عين عين
في التحية. اسمع المجلس من نعيم افندي كلكان وهات معطوش
Thank you. اسطوانات نجمة الشرق الأستاذ رزق الله البني.
طير عقلي وهد الحيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الحيل
لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الحيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الحيل
حلمت النمرة بمنامي السبعة طلعت قدامي حلمت النمرة بمنامي السبعة طلعت قدامي صرت أحسب أرقامي صرت أحسب أرقامي وحسابي رح عب الكيل وحسابي رح عب الكيل
لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الخيل
بين لي اني ربحان حطيت مية على حصان بين لي اني ربحان حطيت مية على حصان والسابي واحد نعسان والسابي واحد نعسان كان ماشي ومقطوع الحيل كان ماشي ومقطوع الحيل
لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الحيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الحيل
كان معي مال بحبح ظنت حالي رح اربح كان معي مال بحبح ظنت حالي رح اربح طلعت من اللعب مشرشح طلعت من اللعب مشرشح وما تغمض جفني بالليل ما تغمض جفني بالليل
لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الخيل
مرة بتربح شريالين ومرات بتخسر ألفين مرة بتربح شريالين ومرات بتخسر ألفين كل خسارة عالحالين كل خسارة عالحالين حالتنا صفت بالويل وحالتنا صفت بالويل
لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الحيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الحيل
في مرة طلعت من البيت واعد مرتي جبلة زيت في مرة طلعت من البيت واعد مرتي جبلة زيت من دربة رحت تخبيت من دربة رحت تخبيت المصاري طاروا عالخيل المصاري طاروا عالخيل
لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الحيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الحيل
قال قالت لدنقنا من البرد من الأمطار وكتر الشرد قالت لدنقنا من البرد من الأمطار وكتر الشرد وإن كنت مخبى يا قرد وإن كنت مخبى يا قرد وزهر كنت زاير الخيل بيظهر كنت زاير الخيل
لا بالخيل لا بالخيل طير علي وهد الخيل لا بالخيل لا بالخيل طير علي وهد الخيل لا بالخيل لا بالخيل طير علي وهد الخيل لا بالخيل لا بالخيل طير علي وهد الخيل
More items from the 1997 Rounder Records album, The Music of Arab Americans, a retrospective collection. I happened to buy this at the Electric Fetus just off of East Franklin Avenue in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm sure it should not be terribly difficult to get a hold of your own copy or download it or whatever off of the internet. That's a bit of a surprise for some of you here who have not heard the item before. Going back, starting with the last item, which was Lieb al-Khayl. Lieb al-Khayl, playing the horses. And with Russell Bunai on vocal and Joe Bedway playing the oud. Before that was Flute Imitation. That's the name of the item. Featuring Naeem Karakand on violin, oud, and drum. And before that, simply Arabic folk songs. St. Jude Hospital Foundation Premier Edition, etc. Who comes to mind when you hear about the St. Jude Hospital Foundation and their activities? None other than Danny Thomas, the late Danny Thomas, actor in his heyday, but later became more pronounced in American film and television culture as a comedian, a comic actor, Danny Thomas. It says here, although Danny Thomas performed widely for the Arab American community, this record, made in 1952, is his only recording of Arabic music. Proceeds from the record, as well as from the numerous haflas presented by Thomas, benefited St. Jude Hospital Foundation, which has become one of the most important institutions in the world for the research and treatment of children's diseases, known as, quote, or known by, quote, mainstream America. Only as a comedian and actor, Thomas continued to sing Arabic songs in cameo and guest performances until just a few months before his death in 1991. And as I pointed out last time I played this, although it says here in these liner notes that this record is his only recording of Arabic music. He had a TV show where he played typical American father, who happened to be of Arabic extraction, Lebanese extraction, I believe. He was featured on the sitcom Make Room for Daddy with his wife and two kids, one of each gender. Make Room for Daddy, there was an episode on the Make Room for Daddy program where they went to Ireland to visit his wife's parents, from where she hailed. And even though they greeted all of them, including Thomas, warmly, Danny Williams, I believe, was the family name Williams on that program. The Irish people in Ireland greeted him warmly, but then he tried to entertain them by playing piano and singing in Arabic, and it kind of freaked his in-laws out, and they treated him definitely at arm's length for the next day or two on that program. But the point is, this is the other recording. If anyone can ever get a hold of that particular episode, I have no idea what year or which number episode that was. I can't even remember what network that Make Room for Daddy showed on. But he sang in Arabic on that as well. I remember that as a child. I saw it just once. Okay. more interesting musical items. This is the Mideast Migraine Show, coming to you here live at 4:21 p.m. on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 on the FM dial, and streaming live at freakradio.org, freakradio.org. For anyone who has not taken advantage of their opportunity to call in and speak with me directly, and most likely be on the air, inevitably this will happen if you do call me. You will go on the airwaves. We'll have a tete-a-tete over the airwaves and on the and online as well. For those who've decided not to do that, you can still drop off a message to me at this program's email address, MideastMadness@gmx.com. That's MideastMadness at G as in gigantic, M as in miniature, X as in somewhere in between, or Xavier or xylophone.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. I also want to make everyone aware of the fact that I archive my programs, which I attempt to record every week. So generally, the great majority of them are available for podcast and replay and sharing and all that good stuff. You need to go to another website, radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.NET, radioforall.net. radioforall.net, and simply type in Mideast Migraines to come across the roughly chronological listing of all my programs going back almost three full years now. The almost three, getting close to my third anniversary of doing Mideast Migraine Show. It was before that, I gave it a go of calling it Mideast Madness, hence the phraseology in the show's email address, MideastMadness@gmx.com. And before that, it was called something else. I barely remember what that was. That didn't last more than a few weeks. The spring of 2012, when I began this mess here. But this is the Mideast Migraine Show with your Palestinian-American host, friendly and local, no less. Palestinian-American, that is, here in Santa Cruz County, California. Ren to Wheel is the name. Ren, R-E-N. Not the exact same spelling as the bird. Came across another item forwarded by David Schermerhorn. Appears to be from the Electronic Intifada. Let me just change the font here to make it a little easier for me to read. And then we'll get going. Increase the size. All right. The Wanted 18. I'm not sure who all these people are. I'll just read it as it's presented here. Thanks for sending, Joe. I'm sharing with my dad here, and we'll look myself once I get off the plane. I'm currently getting on to Rochester. Oh, the English. On April 16, at 4:37 p.m., Najib Joe Hakim wrote the following. Here's the animated comic portrayal of the Israeli occupation, Kate. The trailer is on the link. Joe. Maybe we'll take a look at that. Let's just read the text of this. Beit Sahur's first Intifada heroes celebrated an intelligent, funny film. The Wanted 18, directed by Amir Shamali and Paul Cohen. Something to look for, folks. Intuitive Pictures, the National Film Board of Canada. Pelota Films, Dar Films. When I started reading properly about the first Palestinian Intifada, it was all over. I had experienced the tail end of it. I lived in El Aizariya and worked in Jerusalem in 1992 within the then dynamic yet family-like atmosphere of the Palestine Human Rights Information Center, which, alas, is no more. No more Palestine Human Rights Information Center. Ooh. Its demise is a long story involving its support of banned organizations, disputes over funding, restrictions on West Bank field workers traveling to East Jerusalem, and the death of Palestinian leader Faisal Husseini. It was finished off by the closure of its offices and raid of its database by Israeli forces almost 10 years ago. Sounds like this could be described as another example of divide and conquer. Internal disputes over funding and whatever else, restrictions of its field workers and travel between the field and the offices, the death of its leaders, and finished off by the closure of its offices and raid by the IDF, the IOF, actually, Israeli Occupation Forces, and raid of its database, which means that that's destroyed by now, most likely. Divide and conquer. That's my comments. Let's continue with the actual text. TXT. When I read about the first intifada, I saw Gaza as the shield, Ramallah the brain, and Jerusalem the heart. But there was always a curious little town on the outskirts of Bethlehem that attracted me, Beit Sahur, or perhaps Beit Sahur, which seemed like a flower. The stories from Beit Sahur uplifted and charmed the organized nonviolent resistance, the coordination committees of teachers, doctors, and other professionals, the role of women, the drive for agrarian self-sufficiency, and the strike actions of the pharmacists. Yet in all this, I found no reference to cows. That's right, folks, cows, C-O-W-S. I, like the Israeli forces, must have been looking in the wrong place. The Wanted 18 was a surprise. It is a film about a real story that captivated director Amir Shomali's imagination as a child. The story of how the town of Beit Sahur bought 18 cows from an Israeli kibbutz in order to start producing its own milk. It tells the tale of a town trying to attain independence by boycotting taxes and produce. It is the story of nonviolent resistance, its heroics, and psychology. Back again, folks. Brave men, women, and cows. I saw the film first at the Human Rights Watch Film Festival in Amsterdam. I saw the film first at the Human Rights Watch Film Festival in Amsterdam, knowing nothing about it or its makers. I assumed it was about brave men and women, which indeed it was, but the story was told in such a way that one could only comprehend the people if one also understood the cows, their individuality, and unexplored potential. Maybe, says the narrator, you think cows are lazy eating all day with nothing in their heads. Maybe you should think again. The Wanted 18 is a complex story told playfully. There are comic strips, cartoon figures with big lips, animals with long eyelashes, a magical white calf that defies expectations by leaping over a 2-meter-high fence, and jokes that rely on exaggeration and irony. Cartoon cows fart in the opening scenes. Ha ha. It's a laugh. After the screening, a Skype interview from Ramallah, the de facto Palestinian Authority capital in the West Bank, Shomali was sweet, jokey, with a fresh face and a cutely accented voice. I grew up in a refugee camp in Syria, Shomali's voice chirpily explained. We could not go out, he added without resentment. Boring life, he said, disposing of it. But none of the humor and buoyancy detracts from the force of this film, its intelligence, politics, and careful editorial choices. There are no unwarranted digressions. Each character is given their say and their space as the extraordinary individuals that they are. it is the modestly portrayed gravitas of these personalities that makes this film such an achievement. Even more so when set amid what they have been up against. The only thing we controlled was the air that we breathed, one interviewee states. The occupation, says another, quote, put it into your head that you are subhuman, you are not equal, end quote. Not subhuman, superhuman, not unequal, but confidently superior. Curious. These men and women, Jad Ishak, Siham Tawil, no known relation to me, Hassan Andoni, Jalal Kumsier, Makram Saad, Anton Shomali, and his mother, Ayman Abu Zuluf, Maji Musle, and importantly, the butcher's wife, were exceptional in not only coping with, but challenging great difficulties and developing strategies to survive with dignity and humor. As one Palestinian interviewee states, it was very clear. Mentally, we were superior to them. Good guys, bad guys. For any dramatic story to work, you need heroes and anti-heroes, goodies and baddies. The goodies are those characters listed above. Brave, grounded, articulate, clear-thinking people, many now in their sixth or even eighth decade of life, all have lost friends and family. Many have lost months and years to prison. All live under occupation. The baddies are two men who seem pretty comfortable in their own skins. They are in need of some dental attention, but otherwise they are doing okay. Their hair is cropped short. They wear well-ironed shirts, and occasionally one of them laughs. They are Ehud Zrahia, advisor to the military general on Arab affairs in the Israeli civil administration. Let me read that again. Ehud Zrahia, advisor to the military general on Arab affairs in the Israeli civil administration. Curious, almost contradictory title there for an individual. And Shatil Levy, with the same unit during the first intifada. Zrahia occasionally spied on cows as part of his job, which essentially tasked both he and Levy with destroying the nonviolent resistance in Bait Sahur. This, they explained, was harder to put down than more violent movements in other towns. But it was critical to do so, they stress, as the movement was about to spread. In the short term, it seems that the anti-heroes won this time around. It would have been difficult for them not to. They had, they boasted, quote, all means at their disposal, end quote. They killed, arrested, tortured, imposed curfews, confiscated household belongings. They, quote, made life hell. It took a long time, but the Israeli civil administration won. Zrahia is tanned and laughing. Shatil was promoted. Their zeal to stop the efforts of doctors to sweep the streets and butchers' wives to milk cows to destroy the resistance movement of a town where, and I quote, everybody was giving the little that they could and the whole society was in total harmony, end quote, did not come across as motivated by ideology, but an unquestioning following of orders where moral conscience has been trained to shut down in order for military objectives to be achieved. Shatil Levy even understood where his opponents were coming from. Quote, if I were them, I would not want to pay taxes. I would only pay taxes to my own government. He understood, he emphasized, but yet he destroyed to get a promotion. If you look a little closer, maybe his eyes seem a little tired. It is a terrible legacy to leave behind on a personal basis, even if professionally he was rewarded. Shomali told the Amsterdam audience, what it was like to show the film in Ramallah and invite the propagandists from Beit Sahur. They walked out of the cinema like kings, he said, smiling. And so they should have. They deserve reverence. Their names graffitied on walls, a place in Palestinian history and the history of civil resistance, while the rest of us await the return of the white cow. Or maybe go out and find one ourselves. Okay, now this item was actually written by pretty much a review of the film and circumstances surrounding its showing by Selma Dabach, a British parliamentarian writer. Her debut novel, entitled Out of It, is published by Bloomsbury, 2012. So keep your eyes open for this film, The Wanted 18, or go to the following website, electronicintifada.net. Intifada is spelled, like it sounds, pretty much in English, I-N-T-I-F-A-D-A, electronicintifada.net/content/ And all of these words are separated by hyphens. Beit Sahur's first Intifada heroes celebrated intelligent, funny film. Beit Sahur is spelled B as in boy, E-I-T. Sahur's, S-A-H-O-U-R-S. Although there's no apostrophe, that obviously is possessive phraseology. electronicintifada.net/content/ Beit Sahur's first Intifada heroes celebrated intelligent funny film. I don't know if the entire film is presented there, but you'll get more information at the very least about it there. Okay. Let me just grab this here. Give it a title. Isn't it so much fun listening to someone do their work online while they're also trying to do a radio show? This is the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Lawrence Renswiel, presented by Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 on the FM dial, 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. It's 4:39 p.m. Technically, that gives us another 16 minutes to fart around here. And, okay. I want to pick up on some older items that are indeed older by a few weeks anyway. That I am not able to get across to you on this program over a show that is actually just under 2 hours per week. The other Saturday expression of Mideast Migraines, all Saturday editions are dedicated almost exclusively, normally exclusively, to the reading of important books concerning Palestinians and Israelis and topics such as anti-Semitism, etc., the Middle East conflict in general. Right now I'm reading Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine, a Jewish-American woman in the occupied territories. Fascinating material, excellently presented, very thorough in its documentation, but oh, so difficult to get through from an emotional level. The facts that Balzer conveys through her observations and personal experiences are so painful and just really difficult for me to have to read in order to do the program. That's the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraine Show at 11 a.m. Pacific Time on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Apparently I had not, according to the way I read my I have not read this yet to you, not this particular email, but let's give this a shot.
The United Nations General Assembly is pressing Israel to reveal its nuclear arsenal. Israel has lashed out against the overwhelming approval of the resolution, which calls for international inspectors to be allowed to examine its atomic program. And its foreign minister said the vote was meaningless. The country also rejected a UN-backed conference on a nuke-free Middle East. Israel denies it has nuclear weapons, but refuses to provide proof that it doesn't. Ottis pointlessly tried to lift the veil surrounding Israel's atomic program.
It's a story that has all the ingredients and intrigue of a Hollywood blockbuster. Nuclear smuggling, a Hollywood producer, and an Israeli prime minister. It's a story that here in Tel Aviv, the authorities don't want to talk about. But two Israeli Americans have put pen to paper.
It's probably the least best-kept secret in the world.
On center stage is Arnon Milchan, a Hollywood producer and Israeli undercover agent who is alleged to have smuggled nuclear triggers from the United States into Israel. A Californian engineer, Richard Kelly Smith, says he was recruited by Milchan in the early 70s. Smith was later convicted in the United States of running an American front company to help Milchan. The story first surfaced in FBI files released at the end of last year and in Joseph Gilman's tell-all book, Confidential.
This was a very limited operation. In fact, when the LACAM, which is the Hebrew acronym for Science Liaison Bureau, was established, even the Mossad was unaware of its existence. And only it was basically created behind the backs of Israel's security establishment.
Earlier this year, the FBI released these documents from a seven-year investigation which began in 1985. They show how a network of front companies connected to the Israeli Defense Ministry smuggled nuclear triggers out of the United States to Israel.
What's apparent in the documents is that the Israeli Ministry of Defense would place an order for prohibited items with an Israeli company called Helai Trading. Helai Trading is where Benjamin Netanyahu worked and would meet with Richard Kelly Smith when he visited Israel. Then they would transfer the order to an organization called Milco in California to fulfill the order, violating Export Control Act, and shipping the triggers out of the United States.
They called the operation Project Pinter. All the allegations are based on Smith's testimony, and many have been surprised by their detail.
If you take a look at the documents, Netanyahu is definitely mentioned in the document. And that's what surprised us, because typically you get two types of censors of this type of document. Sometimes they'll block off an entire page. Sometimes they'll just block off a name. In this case, Netanyahu's name is clearly stated in the documents.
In the documents, it is alleged Netanyahu asked Milchan, the Hollywood producer, not to discuss the matter publicly. In a written response to RT, the Israeli Foreign Ministry denied all allegations, which is hardly a surprise, as Tel Aviv's official position is neither to confirm nor deny possession of nuclear arms. Relatively few people have overall knowledge of the Israeli nuclear program, and there are few leaks. The last time an Israeli insider leaked confidential information was way back in 1986. Nuclear technician Mordechai Vanunu was subsequently kidnapped by Israeli agents in Italy and brought back to Israel to face trial, convicted, and served 18 years of jail time, much of it in solitary confinement.
And that operation went on for many years, and Israel successfully achieved the technologies and the materials necessary to obtain the nuclear deterrence arsenal that it has today, probably the fifth largest arsenal in the world.
On the other side of the story, aside from the leaked documents, Washington too is keeping quiet. Israeli nuclear capabilities are some of the most guarded secrets the U.S. government holds. Far more secret, some would argue, than information it has about Iran. But for the foreseeable future, the book on Israel's nuclear secrets is closed. Paula Sleer, RT, Israel.
Woohoo, I made it back just in time. Okay. Gee, I wish I could have been here to listen to most of that, but you know how potty breaks are. So, we have Nuclear Israel, the secret that is not. It's always fascinated me how, mostly through simply avoiding the topic, avoiding the subject and discussion, Israel succeeds in maintaining all this attention on the potentiality of places like Iran God forbid, having their own nuclear weapons, while maintaining this front to the world that Israel doesn't have any of its own. If they gave a figure in the film that you just heard the track from here, if I missed it, but my understanding is Israel has up to 400 separate nuclear warheads, all of them deployable or potentially deployable, whatever that means. Okay, let me. I presented the track to the film to the video here, this news video thing. Now let me just read this. Forwarded to me, Americans want Netanyahu investigated by the FBI for nuclear espionage. Americans want Israel's prime minister to be investigated by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. From, let's see here. Okay. By way of antiwar.com, a blog, it says here, well, this looks like progress. A poll, namely Netanyahu should be investigated for nuclear weapons technology smuggling before his U.S. visit. This particular message was dated January 30th, so it's been sitting around, like I indicated before I opened it up, amongst the things that I never got around to, but I want to present you with unopened material. Netanyahu should be investigated before his U.S. visit, which was last month, by Grant F. Smith. A majority of Americans believe Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu should be investigated by the FBI for nuclear weapons technology smuggling, before being allowed to enter the United States, according to a new poll. And they have the poll here in very tiny letters and graphics, so it's hard for me to read. Results for all respondents, weighted data unavailable for this video, well, the video. Let's see. 54.9% of respondents say he should first be investigated by FBI. 24.8% say that he should be allowed to visit the U.S. Just about a quarter of all respondents say he should be allowed to come into to America here. 15.9% say he should not be investigated or visit the U.S. And 3.4%, less than 3.5%, maintain that he should be banned from the U.S., or choose not to participate. I don't quite understand that statistic. Okay, that's the results of the poll, as I understand it. But Grant F. Smith goes on to say here, basing that article apparently on the poll, in 2012, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the U.S. FBI, declassified and released files of its investigation into how 800 nuclear weapons triggers, 800 triggers were illegally smuggled from the U.S. to Israel. The FBI declassified and released those files 3 years ago. According to the FBI, the Israeli Military of Defense ordered nuclear triggers, known as Krytrons, K-R-Y-T-R-O-N-S, encrypted radios, ballistic missile propellants, and other export prohibited items through a network of front companies. Smuggling ring operations leader Richard Kelly Smith, S-M-Y-T-H, alleged that Netanyahu worked at one of the fronts, Heli Trading, owned by confessed spy and Hollywood producer Arnon Milchan, and met with him frequently to execute smuggling operations. We're talking about the current prime minister of the Jewish state of Israel right now. Smith, or Smythe perhaps, alleged that Netanyahu himself worked at one of these front companies, Heli Trading. Continuing now with Smith's article, Grant F. Smith. Apparently no relation to the guy I just mentioned before him. The poll was commissioned by the Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy, IRMEP, When informed of the incident, most Americans, 54.9%, as I indicated, indicate that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu should be investigated by the FBI before an upcoming U.S. visit. Israel officially designated the smuggling operation Project Pinto. Smith, S-M-Y-T-H, was captured, prosecuted, and incarcerated in 2002 after years on the run as an international fugitive. The Krytrons were believed to be destined for Israel's clandestine nuclear weapons program. Only 25.8%, roughly a quarter of Americans polled, believe that Netanyahu should be allowed to freely visit the U.S., while 15.9% said he should neither be investigated nor allowed to enter the U.S. When questioned by Israeli and Russian media about the smuggling affair, the Israeli foreign minister denied involvement. Younger respondents, age 18 to 24 and 25 to 34, those two ranges, are generally more likely to want Netanyahu investigated, 73.6% and 62%, respectively, than older Americans. Younger respondents generally more likely to want the prime minister investigated. Responses vary little between income categories. However, females, 63.4%. were more likely than males, 50.4%, to prefer Netanyahu be criminally investigated before being allowed to enter America. Netanyahu has recently announced plans to break diplomatic protocol and address the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, and Congress in March 2015 without coordinating his state visit with the White House. And, of course, this item that I'm reading from, dating back to late January, of course, these events occurred. Since then, continuing with this older article here, the IRMEP poll, with a margin of error of plus or minus 2.5%, was fielded January 26 to 28 by Google Consumer Surveys and received 1,507 responses. The poll question: response choices and statistically significant results may be viewed online and cross-tabulated. Article author Grant F. Smith is the author of America's Defense Line, the Justice Department's Battle to Register the Israel Lobby as Agents of a Foreign Government. Well, I'll have to take a real close look at that. I had no idea that the Justice Department was deigning to in such a battle. Another interesting resource for me to take a look at and convey to you later. Smith currently serves as Director of Research at the Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy in Washington, IRMEP, D.C., Washington, D.C. Let's see. There's a website associated with this article, www.businessinsider.com, specifically businessinsider.com/, all these words separated by hyphens, Arnon Milchan, A-R-N-O-N, hyphen M-I-L-C-H-A-N, and Israel's Nuke Program, -2013-11. Okay, we're at the end of my program. Thank God. I don't know, something's happening to me in my semi-old age here. I'm not sure what it is right at the moment. But let me invite you to return next Monday at 3 o'clock Pacific Daylight Time. Show is always on throughout the year. It starts the current scheduling as it was when I started this program almost 3 years ago. was always 3 p.m. except for the first few months when I only had an hour-long program and I started at 4. But I've been going strong for over 2.5 years now, beginning at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Mondays. You're welcome to return next week at that time. And, of course, join me for the continued reading of A. Balzer's Witness in Palestine for the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines, 11 a.m. Saturday. So there. Thank you. Ta-ta.